Accession number 9146, rule number 10.
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, tape 10. You've mentioned about the development of some of the technology during the war. I think particularly when we were looking at the years 1915-1916. How did our technology compare with the Germans, do you think, so far as artillery was concerned, throughout the course of the war? Would they have been superior to us in the beginning, perhaps? But perhaps...
They were superior in that they'd already... They'd trained for the war and we hadn't. And the first thing I believe that we had to learn was you cannot deploy your guns in view of the enemy. They'll be smashed at once. Now at Lakato, I think it's Lakato, not Mons, the divisions sent their guns right up among the infantry, lying on their stomachs shooting. And they had guns with six horses and drivers on top of them, out in the open, galloping up the guns and dropping it. There wasn't a hope in hell. I believe three divisions did that and suffered terribly. The fourth division was commanded by a gunner, and he put his guns well back behind the hill. And with his own gunfire, he stopped the German advance at Lakato. And I believe that is the true story of how it happened.
But do you think their actual technology was better than ours?
I wouldn't have said so, not from what one's angle. I think we were... Our technique was just as good. We were at great disadvantage in many places where the Germans had the choice of ground before they really settled down to the long trench warfare. And the Germans seemed somehow always to fetch up on the high ground and us on the low ground. And that meant us in the mud and the flooding of the water drainage system.
You mentioned one or two of the heavy guns you came into contact with. Did you ever see the railway guns, you know, Bosch Buster?
Yes, I saw them on the railways. They were, I suppose, more or less naval guns, because these huge, great things they were, with, I suppose, the shells. You've seen the shells at the Imperial War Museum. Well, that's I think it's a 15-inch gun, that. And that was what they had. What we went for more, really, was howitzers. Now, a howitzer is a gun with a varying charge, so that you can vary the angle of descent of the shell. So if you want to get into something, you send it up high and let it come down. And if it's not as much as that, you can use a gun for the straight, flat trajectory.
Could I ask you now about your horses? You know, horses have cropped up quite a bit in our interview, haven't they?
Yes.
And you've mentioned, you know, some of the sufferings of the horses.
Yes.
Vets would seem to have been very important at the front.
Vets.
The role of the vet, is that right?
Frightfully important, yes. And a good vet, like my friend Mickey, was absolutely invaluable.
They must have been kept very busy, I would think, from what
they were
saying.
There was one bit of busyness by the vets, which I should feel ashamed of, but it's so long ago that I'm not going to feel ashamed of. I told you how the Australians tried to pinch Mickey's charger. Well, that was in the winter of 1916. In the summer of 1917, I think it was the night before the big offensive was launched, the 3rd Ypres, we found ourselves, and I was a captain at that moment, we found ourselves next door to the Australians. And Mickey decided to have his revenge. And he went down to the Australian horse lines, looked them over and pinched a good one. Untied it from its shackles and brought it up to where I was in a little bivouac. And look at this wedders, he said. And I said, Mickey, where the hell do you get that? He said, oh, There's lots more down the Australians. I'm going back for some more. And he finished up by stealing from the Australian lines something like a dozen horses, by which time it had become almost an open scandal. And I said, Mickey, you can't take all these bloody horses. The Australians are bound to find them. You might have got away with one, but you can't have a dozen of their horses and stick to them. The Australians will know them. And so I made Mickey take these horses right out 4 or 5 miles and turn them loose. So I wasn't going to be had for that as a court martial.
Did they have a sort of hospital for the horses, the wounded ones?
Well, they did have sick lines in each unit. And yes, you did have sick bays in some areas. During the Somme winter, in the quieter part of the time, I was pulled out from my battery and told to go with my great friend Bill Duncan, no, not with Bill, with Mickey, told to go and set up a rehabilitation centre for ailing horses. That's horses with not digesting their food, looking awful, or, you know, in a bad state of health. Great deal cold, though later on we had 2 horse rugs for each horse. Special wagons carrying the horses, horse rugs. But where did I get to?
You were saying about this convalescent
house. Oh, yes, yes. I was told, put in charge of it. So with Mickey, we settled down to it. We got the horses all warm. The first way you warm a horse when he's really cold and shivering and looking miserable is to rub his legs and pull his ears. And you get the blood going round through their ears and through their legs, up as far as the hocks and the knee. That is the great way to warm a horse when he's in a miserable state. And that, and adjusting the food. Now, when you find they've passed their oats, it means they're not digesting the oats, so they're not getting any benefit from the oats. So you give them something different. And in our case, we fed them on masses of bran and plenty of hay and got special ration allowances and crushed the oats, which helped tremendously. And I did this for 2 or 3 weeks. It's very nice for me. It's out of the line from the guns and the OPs for a fortnight or so, when you, or a month might have been, when you were completely at peace with yourself and with everything else, and enjoying it, the job that you liked. Afterwards, I've had a similar job several times in my later career, which is possibly for another day, but not tonight.
Could I ask you more about your living conditions? You've explained how once you had lice. Was that on just one occasion you caught
it? I think that was the only time I had lice. They established very early on divisional baths where men went in and they were stripped and given fresh clothing, and their clothing was cleaned and de-infested from lice. It was a de-lousing places. And all the troops had to go through, whenever they came out from the line to rest, they did that. Because, you see, all these beddings, where they all slept on straw in barns, the people behind the lines, people in the trenches didn't even have that. But they got very, very lousy. And, of course, it's a horrible thing.
Is it? You know, do you feel uncomfortable when you...
It's, I mean, something... They used to get into the seams of your shirt and you'd see them looking there and then squeeze you. Okay, but it's a filthy job. And the lice seemed to like coming out on a nice sunny day, which is when the troops would all take their shirts off and get a hot iron if they could.
How about rats? Were you ever plagued with rats?
I didn't see all this business of rats eating the corpses. I'm sure it happened. I know it happened. But the only time I had personal contact with the rats was just looking over the Loose Plain. I had a wonderful OP in the water tower. And at the bottom of the water tower, a comfortable little corner to put my bed. And I used to sleep there. And the little boy from the village used to bring up the Continental edition of the Daily Mail up to my OP. It was most amusing. And I remember waking up with the rats running over my body and my face. But not nibbling at me. And I don't know why, I suppose my soldier servant is one of his jobs is to see his young officer didn't get rats.
Was it important to you to have your soldier servant?
Vital. Man? That war and this last war too. I had very good service in both. They just put me first.
Could I ask you now about your relationship with your men? It would seem from what you've been saying that you had pretty good relations other ranks.
I had very good. I was awfully fond of them. And they treated me as a sort of a pet, these old sweats. Men with beards and great big moustaches and these back from the Far East when the war started. And there was me, a callow little boy with one pot star on my sleeve. And I think they did that. They saw me through. They helped me out whenever they could.
Do you think?
Yes, I had good condition with them. My eldest son, when he got his commission this last war, he said, "Dad, how do I get the troops to like me?" And I said, "Well, that's quite easy. All you've got to do is to like them enough and they'll like you. But you've got to like them. You've got to be very, very fond of your men."
How about the relationship between the top brass and the staff officers and the officers serving in the line?
Oh, it was what I read out to you, that poetry. Yes, it was very, very bad. It was. I gave those rhymes and a sketch of the little man walking on Duckmoor to Oliver Chandos, a few years ago, just before he died. And he was tickled pink with it. And he said that, he wouldn't go on the back staff. He was on the brigade staff, which was as good as the man with the rifle.
Did you find in World War II that the situation was different, or was it the same as that? You know,
was it the troops?
Yes, between the top, the top brass, the staff officers.
I would like to say it was completely different. Mind you, I was more or less in the top brass, so I looked at it with different eyes. But I think that was it. I go now on the Saturday before Armistice Day, and the president of the Second War Division's old comrades. There's about up to 200 people go to it, at all. And they turn up and they're frightfully nice to me. I turn up there every year to conduct the dinner and be president, and say the least I can. And they kind of crowd round one and talk about old days and everything. And it's genuine.
So do you think things were better in World War II?
Much. Mind you, I think one of the great assets we had from World War I was the experience of World War I for those who survived. You get Lord Alexander, Archie Wavell, Bill Slim, and all those senior officers. They'd all been through it. Monty. They were determined not to have the same slaughters as the First War. I know that from every angle. I've always heard that. There were men killed, and lots of people killed at Alamein and so on. We didn't have too many killed in the army I was with, but there's no question whatever was what we got on very well indeed. I mean, on Christmas Eve, the Second War, it's not on, oh God. on Christmas Eve, we got into a very serious trouble in Tunisia, and I was waiting at my headquarters for orders, and then the general rang through and said, "We're pulling back tonight, you've got to shift your guns back." And I went up to one of my medium batteries, and when I got there, the colonel said, "Thank God you've come, sir." Well, that's...
That wouldn't have happened in World War I, you think?
Well, I don't think it would. But mind you, there were some... My friend Bill Duncan, he was a wonderful chap, and he was entirely a regimental soldier, as well as a first-class staff officer with a very good brain. His only crab was that he was mad on air, and he loved going up in balloons and things, which is not really his job. But it was, because it was all experiments and development. But there was very little love lost with the staff.
Could I ask you now about the lighter side of things. You have hinted that you had quite a bit of fun.
Had what?
You had quite a bit of fun while you were at the front, as well as all this horror and sort of suffering.
Well, when
you did have laughs and you enjoyed yourself.
Yes, one did.
One
made the most of it, and one had an opportunity. I mean, when we got down near this place, Béthune, I think it was, I remember one day we went in with one or two of my pals, we rode into the town, and we went around the shopping, and we went to a boot shop, and there were two very pretty little French girls, at least we thought they were, there, and one of them, playing about with me, she touched my eyebrows, leisurely, something like that. And at that moment, the colonel came in the door, gave a loud cough and a loud laugh, and went straight out again.
Did you have much music in the trenches?
No, but quite early on, I wrote home, I think it is, and got a gramophone sent out to me, and I used to take it up the trenches, and the poor old BI, PBI, they used to love it. I used to play Mary from Tipperary, was one of them, and I can't remember, there were about four records. I used to play them up and down the trenches.
Did the troops sing much, or whistle?
No, no, they didn't. They sang carols on Christmas Eve, as I've already said, I think. But I don't remember them doing much singing. Sang on the march quite a lot. Of course, they moved an awful lot on their flat feet, poor chaps, as opposed to going in a car or a tank or something today.
These songs, would they have been the war songs we think of as typical? You know, it's a long way to Tipperary.
Yes, I think
this
so.
Sort of thing.
Oh, yes. Tipperary was almost the British national anthem.
Did you ever meet any of the war poets? Did anyone you know write poetry about the war?
I never met them.
Did you read those poems later?
No, I'm almost illiterate. And I haven't read a book for a long time. I've got a few things on my plate, and it's very slow work doing what I feel I ought to do. But I want to. I want to have a quiet winter to myself, just with me and Anne, and go through some of these things that still interest me.
You described very vividly your fear at the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Ypres.
Yes.
Did you find many cases of shell shock as you went through the war? You know, were there men who couldn't cope with the situation?
I don't remember ever seeing one, but I know it did happen. And a great friend of mine and a very big general who's been dead now, Charles Alfrey, he said, I call shell shock funk, that's all there is to it.
Would you say the same?
Well, Lord Morland, I think it was, wrote a book on morale, in which he says everybody has a limit. And I think it's partly one's imagination and partly one's physical fitness and one's mental state of despair or rashness or exuberance. Or, of course, and I suppose it did happen quite a bit, extra rum issued before you went over the parapet, a bit more rum, you know, just as you feel a bit different when you've got a bit of liquor on board, don't you? Yes, but I can't remember ever seeing anybody break down.
How about punishments? Were you ever involved with having to punish your troops, or did you ever witness anyone being punished?
Yes, one did punish them. They required it. There was a thing called Field Punishment Number 1.
What was that?
That was pretty ruthless, Field Punishment Number 1. And a man was tied to a gun wheel for 2 hours a day, I think it was, and was on bread and water. But that gradually got superseded and was regarded not fit for decent troops or the British Army. And that, I think, died out, Field Punishment Number 1, which is pretty ruthless. Otherwise, you could put them at the bottom of the leave roaster, all sorts of ways if you wanted to punish them, but there wasn't much grounds for it. Men coming back late from leave usually landed in for so many days CB or something, combined to barracks, which didn't sound much, but it was like a black mark on his conduct sheet.
How about court-martials? Were you ever involved with court-martials?
Court-martials were... They came from a number of causes. Cowardice in the face of the enemy, theft, disobedience of an order, insult, striking a senior officer, various things like that. And I was, on one occasion, in my spell, odd spells of being a field officer, i.e. A major, I was appointed president of a court-martial, which meant I was presiding. There was a captain and a subaltern on it, and we tried these people. And this particular man was a real old sweat, and they were so stupid and dull that it was nobody's belief. And one old man got onto a tube station on leave and couldn't get his way off it, and he was a day late. And he didn't know how he got off the tube, or said so, anyhow. But the particular case I'm thinking of, a gunner was accused of being in possession of a comrade's kit. Now that meant he'd pinched his comrade's kit. His comrade was sick, or absent on leave in England or something, absent for some reason or other. But he was put up in front of me as his president to try for this charge of being in possession of his pal's kit. The court took the evidence. No doubt he had his friend's things marked and his this, that and the other, but he said, well, my mate was away on sick and I looked after his stuff for him. And we were very puzzled about it, and I was in although the oath of a court-martial is to try the accused without favour, without favour and affection or something, I forget the oath now. I was very sorry for this old man in front of me on this charge. And so we closed the court to consider our finding, and I rather led off as a youngster of about 22, to saying that he obviously was in possession of his comrade's kit, but nobody said it was in improper possession, that he oughtn't have had it. And he says that his comrade, his mate, wanted him to have it, without partiality, favour or affection. That is what the oath of a president of a court-martial. And so we decided we'd find him guilty of the charge because he had the kit. But there was no offence under the Army Act. Looking up the Army Act, there was... I maintained, and my court agreed with me, God knows why, that the charge should have been being in improper possession of his comrade's kit. So we dismissed the case. And this raised a proper fear all the way up in the high levels of the legalistic army people, in the corps or the army, or the army headquarters. And almost at once, an order was issued from general headquarters that in future only field officers, not substantive, that is full rank of field officers, that is major and upwards, only field officers may be appointed in future as presidents of court-martials. And I suppose they added, this did not apply to temporary majors or acting majors. And I maintain that I did the whole of the British Expeditionary Force a very good turn. It struck a whole lot of people off the onerous and unpleasant duty of court-martial.
Were there any rackets that you knew of?
Any what?
Any rackets going on?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. I suppose there are always rackets whenever there's an army about, and there are always people who would take a chance. The personal racket I met was going on leave. When you got your leave warrant, say now, you put it in your pocket, you shook hands with your brother officers, and away you went out of that window to find the first vehicle or train going south to Boulogne or Calais, where the leave boat went from. Well, I got my leave, and I jumped a lorry or an ambulance or something, got down to Boulogne, and there was the leave boat. Thank God for a day early, a day extra, an extra night in London, marvellous. I went on board, and I was stopped by a regimental sergeant major of a famous infantry regiment, who said, "Your ticket is not valid till tomorrow, sir." I said, "Well, damn it, it's a day early, and we always get away early." He said, "I can't help that."
But he didn't
mention it, and I didn't see it. I thought an officer can't go and bribe a senior NCO, but I was very angry. It did nobody any good, and it would have given me an extra night's expense and pleasure in London town. So that was a racket. There was trouble at Etaples, which was the big staging area of troops, of reinforcements coming out from England, and so on. And at that place there was a row between the Australians and the military police. Well, the Australians had been in action a good time, and they were soldiers. And the military police had been down at the base, probably, and a lot of them had anyhow, most of the war. And for some reason there was a row, and I think an Australian was killed in a fight or something. Anyhow, the row proceeded, and the troops just took the law into their own hands. Troops of gunners, sappers, infantry, cavalry, everything, any mixture down at Etaples, they formed themselves up and they did a march of protest with a biscuit tin band through the town of Etaples. There was a hell of a row about it. It was called the Etaples Riots. But you'd only got to see any of your own men in this, and they'd obey your orders straight away. There was no question about it, anything against the regimental officers. They were very close indeed to each other. Well, there's no doubt whatever in my mind that it was pretty widespread.
You've had a very long war. It seems incredible that you survived all these things. How many officers out of your battery did survive?
Well, from the original, my major, Tim Thackeray, managed to get out after being wounded in the lungs at Bois Grenier. He survived and lived for some time afterwards. Paul Trefus, a funny little Jew, VNAP Trefus Diamond Merchants, a most delightful little character, he survived too, but I don't think any of the others did. And there was a story going round that I was the only surviving officer of the whole division. I was untouched by illness or wounds the whole war. And I was amazingly, incredibly lucky.
Well, Brigadier, thank you very much indeed for sharing your experiences with us.